This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the goals of healthcare reform is to control ballooning healthcare costs. My guest, Maggie Mahar, is the author of the 2006 book, Money-Driven Medicine, The Real Reason Healthcare Costs So Much, which has just been adapted into a film by Alex Gibney, who also made the documentaries Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room, and the Academy Award-winning Taxi to the Dark Side. The film Money-Driven Medicine will soon be available on DVD. Mahar is a healthcare fellow at the Century Foundation, where she writes the blog HealthBeat. She's a former financial journalist. Mahar says we need to reform the system because in a decade, healthcare costs will double where they are now, and studies show that $1 in $3 spent on healthcare is wasted on redundant or ineffective treatments. Maggie Mahar, welcome to Fresh Air. One of your main concerns is that we need to eliminate unnecessary and ineffective treatments.
That's right. But that has to be done very carefully. I mean, this is not fat that's hanging out on the edges of the steak where you can see it. This is fat that's marbled through the meat. So we need to take a scalpel and very carefully excise that waste. And that's why we need a panel of physicians, healthcare experts, looking at the evidence. That's what President Obama has proposed, having an independent, bipartisan panel of doctors and other medical experts that is shielded from Congress and lobbyists to a large degree, that is simply looking at the medical evidence and making decisions about which are the most effective treatments for patients who fit a particular medical profile, and then issuing guidelines, not rules, but guidelines that will help doctors and steer them and patients toward the most effective treatments.
In the book, in your book, You write that market forces have splintered the healthcare system and that it's now this Hobbesian marketplace where it's a war of all against all, and it's pitting the healthcare industry's players against one another. Hospital versus hospital, doctor versus doctor, hospital versus insurer, insurer versus hospital, insurer versus drug maker versus drug maker. That's making it more expensive. I mean, market forces are supposed to keep prices down through competition. You're saying it's making it more expensive?
That's right. In healthcare, market forces don't bring prices down. We've seen that everything becomes more expensive every year, drugs, hospital stays. In other markets, the consumer has the power to bring prices down as producers compete with each other. But it's because a consumer can say, you know, that laptop is a little expensive. I'm going to wait until a competitor, a rival, comes out with a less expensive laptop that will meet my needs. When you're sick, you can't say, I'll wait until a less expensive cancer drug comes out. 80% of our healthcare dollars are spent on patients who are seriously ill, suffering from chronic diseases like cancer. They don't have the choice to wait. They need what they need at that moment. And so they can't help bring prices down by comparison shopping, by putting off the purchase, by any of those things. They essentially have to take whatever it is that the doctor or the hospital tells them that they need at that time.
So what kind of systemic change do you think we need to change this competitive relationship to a collaborative relationship?
Recently, I attended a conference sponsored by the Institute for Healthcare Improvement and Dartmouth. And at that conference, they looked at 10 communities where healthcare spending is low and quality of care is very high. And these are diverse communities ranging from Sacramento to Tallahassee, Florida. These are communities, what they have in common is in each of these communities, doctors and hospitals have gotten together and agreed to collaborate. In many cases, they've agreed also to get away from fee-for-service payments and instead they accept what are called bundled payments, where the hospital and all the doctors involved in an episode of care receive a lump sum that usually goes to the hospital and then is divided up among them. This means that they have a motivation to work with each other. The House legislation has many suggestions for reforming the way Medicare pays for care and suggestions for how Medicare can provide incentives that would change the way doctors and hospitals deliver care so that it would be more patient-centered, more cooperative, less competitive.
Do you think that there are perverse incentives in the system right now?
Definitely. The biggest one is paying fee-for-service, because when you pay fee-for-service, you're telling the doctor, we want you to do more. The more you do, the more we'll pay you. We're going to pay you for the quantity of work you do. We're paying you for volume. We're paying you piecework as if you were a factory worker. What we should be doing is paying doctors for the quality of work they're doing, for good outcomes. We have more than two decades of research from Dartmouth showing that one out of three healthcare dollars is wasted doing more. More aggressive care, more intensive care, more tests, more treatments does not lead to better outcomes. Often outcomes are worse because a patient is being overtreated, and that means he's being exposed to treatments that provide no benefit, yet every treatment has some risk, so he's being exposed to risks without benefit.
When I go to my doctors, I always feel like they look so rushed and harried, and I assume that that's because there's pressure on them by insurance companies or their institutions to see a lot of patients. I don't get the feeling like it's that they want to do more procedures so that they can personally make more money. Are there pressures on them from either the institution they work for or the health insurance company to see as many patients as possible?
Certainly not from the health insurance company. The health insurance company would rather they did less because then the health insurance company would owe them less. Some institutions, perhaps, but basically this is an internal pressure. As doctors will tell you very honestly, I have to see a patient every 15 minutes or I can't keep the lights on. I can't keep my practice afloat. The only way I can make it financially is if I see a patient every 15 minutes. I hate this. I wish this weren't the case, but that's the way it is. Now, in terms of primary care, that's because we don't pay enough for primary care. The fees that we pay primary care doctors are very low. Many primary care doctors make $110,000, $115,000 a year. If they have recently graduated from medical school, they may have $250,000 in debt. So they don't want to have to churn patients, but they have no choice if they're going to stay financially afloat.
So there's a big gap now between what primary care doctors earn and what specialists earn?
Yes, absolutely. Specialists often earn 3, 4, 5, 6 times as much as primary care doctors. Now, they've gone to school longer, so they should be – it makes sense that they'd be earning some more, but does it really make sense that they would earn 4 or 5 times as much every year over the course of a 30-year career? Probably not. One thing that the House legislation – is doing is, first of all, it calls for raising primary care fees by at least 5% and by 10% in regions where there's a shortage of primary care doctors. That would also apply to geriatricians and pediatricians under the public sector plan. So these are increases in fees under Medicare First and under the public sector plan. In addition, the House legislation gives Medicare the freedom to set fees with an eye to benefit to patients. Right now, fees for specialists are set with an eye to what it costs the specialist to provide the treatment. Nowhere in the equation does anyone ask how much does a patient benefit. It's all about how much it costs the doctor. The new legislation would let Medicare begin to set fees more with an eye to benefit for patients. That means that some specialist fees for certain treatments that we know are only marginally effective might go down. At the same time, it's definite that fees for primary care would be going up. And in addition to raising the fees, the House legislation calls for loan forgiveness for medical students who choose to become primary care doctors. Right now, many med students feel they can't afford to go into primary care. It just doesn't pay well enough.
As we look to reform the healthcare system in the United States, what are some of the things you think we can learn from the successes and failures of Medicare?
Good question. Well, the failures of Medicare is that it is spending millions, billions of dollars on ineffective and unnecessary treatments because it hasn't sorted out and looked at the comparative effectiveness of various treatments. So that's something that needs to be reformed and changed about Medicare, and that's something that the current administration already is planning on doing. Successes of Medicare, I think, is that it's a consistent program that provides equal care for everyone. It doesn't matter how much you put into the system. It doesn't matter whether you're wealthy or poor. everyone gets the same quality and amount of care. And that, I think, is terribly important. And we want a health care reform system that provides equal care for all at the same price. And that's something that is going to happen under the legislation, which says that private insurers will no longer be able to charge you more if you have a pre-existing condition. And they won't be able to take your insurance away because they discover a pre-existing condition. Everyone in a given community will pay the same amount, except private insurers will be allowed to charge older people up to twice as much as they charge younger people. This, I think, is very unfortunate.
And what you're saying is that younger people have to pay to make the larger system work. So if only sick
people
are buying insurance, it's going to be incredibly unaffordable.
Yeah, well, I mean, younger people will also be under a mandate to buy insurance. The question is whether they pay less for the insurance than older people. Mm-hmm. If younger people pay less, then older people have to pay more or there won't be enough money in the pool. But I think that the Obama administration realizes that young people in this country, many of them are not happy about the mandate, about the idea that they're going to have to buy insurance. And in order to soften the blow, the administration and congressional Democrats are saying, you do have to buy insurance, but since you're young and healthy, you don't have to pay as much for it.
Let's take a look at insurance companies. A lot of people feel like they're suffering under the burden of enormous health care costs, even if they have insurance. How are the insurance companies doing?
They're not doing very well either, because the cost of health care has been spiraling. In recent years, private insurance companies have been paying out more and more each year for health care. Reimbursements have been going up 8% a year, year after year. That means insurance companies are paying out 8% more each year to doctors and hospitals. They've been raising premiums at a very rapid rate as well, trying to pass those costs along, but they've just about kept up with rising costs. That's why your premiums have been spiraling. The insurer's administrative costs have not gone up. Their profits, in many cases, have not been very good. The insurers who've done well are the insurers who offer Medicare Advantage, because the Bush administration decided that if insurers would offer Medicare, this is for-profit private insurers, we would pay them 13% more than Medicare spends to treat the same patients. So we gave them a bonus, really corporate welfare, and that has helped many insurers be profitable in recent years. However, under the current health reform legislation, those Medicare Advantage bonuses are going to be cut, and insurers are going to be in trouble. Insurers are going to have to become more efficient in order to survive.
What will that likely mean for us, the patients?
It should actually mean good things if insurers are wise. Insurers are going to be forced to compete with the public sector option. And insurers are going to be told you can no longer cherry pick, you can no longer avoid sick patients and only insure healthy people. So that means insurers are going to have to pay more attention to the quality of care that they are providing. That means they're going to have to try to get the very best hospital and doctor networks together and provide some sort of bonuses or encouragement for those doctors and hospitals to collaborate, to focus on patient-centered medicine, to focus on quality of care. Up until now, insurers have largely focused on keeping their costs down and not so much on encouraging the highest quality care from their providers. But that was going to have to be their focus if they want to compete with the public sector option and survive.
The word choice is a word you hear coming up a lot. People want choice. They want to be able to choose their doctors. And I'm wondering what choice means to you, and if you think there are choices that as the system is reformed, we're going to have to give up.
I think that people are unnecessarily fearful, partially because they don't understand that the health care they have now is not very good. The U.S. does not have the best health care in the world. And medical researchers and doctors will tell you this. If you read in medical journals, you'll see studies done by American doctors comparing outcomes for various diseases. Outcomes are often not the best in the U.S. In terms of managing chronic diseases, we rank quite low. So no one wants to believe this because people want to feel, well, I can trust my doctor and I know my doctor is the best and what he's doing is the very best possible thing he could do for me. To think anything else is scary. So when people worry about losing something, they're worrying about losing something in the context of thinking that what they have now is better than it really is. Secondly, if we didn't reform the system, you have to remember what the president said in a recent press conference, which is the system we have now is a plan where costs are going to double in the next 10 years. And many of you who now have insurance will find yourself uninsured, alone in a market where you have to somehow or other come up with the money to pay for insurance that is twice as costly as it is today. That's the alternative to health care reform. So whatever an individual may feel he's giving up, A, it probably won't be something that actually helps him, and B, the alternative, not reforming health care, is catastrophic.
I think a lot of people are worried that they won't be able to afford to buy their own insurance in the new system after the legislation has passed, and that the public option will be an inferior plan, and that if they take the public option, they won't get the kind of health care that they want. Are you concerned about that?
Not at all. The public option will be very similar to Medicare. Most people who have Medicare are very happy with most of the coverage. It doesn't include long-term care, and this troubles people. But on the whole, if you look at satisfaction and you poll people, what we found is that people with Medicare are much happier than people with employer-based private insurance. The public sector option, if you actually read the House bill, the 1,018-page House bill, which I have read, you find that the public sector option covers virtually everything that you can think of, including mental health care, including dental care and vision care for children. It also stipulates that there be no copays for primary care, which means people won't put off going for primary care. And it really covers, you know, hospitalization, doctor care, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a full menu, a very comprehensive coverage. In terms of being able to afford the public sector option or private insurance, the subsidies are also very generous. The subsidies cover people up to four times the poverty level. So the subsidies will be available to families earning up to about $88,000 a year. The statistical middle class is clustered around people earning $60,000 for a household a year. So we're talking about offering some subsidy to most of the middle class and a tiny bit of the upper middle class as well. You know, this will be affordable. Certainly it will cost something. And people may find themselves spending as much as 10% of their income, their gross income, on health insurance. For people who now have employer-based insurance, with their employer paying typically 75% of the cost if you're an upper-income employee, those people may find that they're paying more for insurance if they decide to give up their employer-based insurance, or if their employer decides to drop the insurance.
If you had your way,
right,
what kind of system would you create? Would it be a single-payer system? Would it be a whole lot of options like is being proposed now? Obviously, you don't want to keep the system the way it is. You've made that very clear.
Right. If I were Tsarina, this is what I would do. I would create a hybrid system, much like the system that the Obama administration is trying to create, where you have both public sector insurance and the option of private sector insurance. I would like to see that private sector insurance be nonprofit insurance. In other words, insurance companies that don't have to worry about generating a profit, that don't have to try to juggle priorities. Should I try to please my shareholders or should I try to please my customers? We have some very good nonprofit insurers in this country. Kaiser Permanente in Northern California is excellent. Geisinger is excellent. I would like to see them in the mix along with a government insurance program. I'd like to see everyone paying the same percentage of their income into the pool to help pay for health insurance for all of us. Why don't I want a single-payer plan? First of all, it would be enormously difficult to persuade everyone in this country who has employer-based insurance to give it up and go into an unknown government plan. Secondly, and maybe even more importantly, a government plan, if that was all we had, depending on the politics of the government, could take away things that many of us feel are necessary to health care. It could become very stingy. It could decide only to cover certain people. It could decide to penalize people who were fat or who were had other, you know, problems, mental health problems, etc. And that's why I would always want an escape hatch. I'd always want alternatives to the public sector plan and for Americans to be free to choose which plan they wanted.
Well, Maggie Mahar, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Maggie Mahar is the author of Money Driven Medicine, which has just been adapted into a film that will soon be available on DVD. She's a healthcare fellow at the Century Foundation, where she writes the blog Healthbeat. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.